Major Fossil, reel one.
Can you tell me which unit you were in 1942 when the Dieppe raid took place?
Number 4, Commander.
Can you tell me how you came to join the commandos in the first place?
I volunteered. I was on boy service. I joined the army in 1939 at the age of 16. And I came on to man service in 1941. I was with the RASC when I came on to man service. And I was to have gone to the 3rd Infantry Division. The posting didn't come about. And I was at the holding depot of the RASC, which was at that time based in Woking, in Surrey. During the period that I was there, which was 2 months, various officers from the commandos came around on a recruiting drive, showing film shows, lecture tours of commando activities. In those days, primarily it was the Norwegian actions at Lofoten, Vågsø, and various other islands around the Norwegian fjords. To me, as a young lad of 17 and a half, this seemed exciting, and I was quite enthusiastic. Rather than staying in a depot, I wanted to see, not necessarily action, but I wanted to be an active part of the British Army for which I joined. There were several other volunteers, and I was only about one of, I think, 17 from our group that were accepted for commando training. And I was interviewed by the then Brigade Major, Major Dunning White, of the 8th Hussars. I went up to Achnacarry for my commando training, and back to number 4 commando, to Lord Lovett's, after I'd passed my commando training up there. And I was up there with the police intake. A lot of volunteers from the Metropolitan Police and various other constabularies were sent up there. And the majority of these ex-policemen, as it were transferred to number 4 commando or volunteered for number 4 commando. Some went to number 3, some went to number 6. And those that were fluent in other languages were asked if they could go into number 10. But I personally went to number 4. Because of my clerical experience, being a boy soldier, I was trained as a clerk in the RASC. I was elected to go into the orderly room. I hadn't been in the orderly room very many days when there was a notice on the board asking for volunteers for parachute training. And we were to get another 2 shilling a day. Well, this suited me nice. I was a young lad and I wanted as much money as I can lay my hands on. So I volunteered for parachute training. I went to Ringway, did my necessary jumps, qualified with my parachute badge, came back to commando, and looking for the next lot of training and courses that one could go on to qualify for more pay, when they were asking for volunteers for special operations, because no one would be told precisely when these operations were taking place, where they were going to take place. But they always gave you the opportunity to volunteer, even although you'd volunteered for the commandos. It was still not... The whole commando didn't go on these operations. They were just a selected few. Now, 4 commando at that time, I think, was about 480 to 500 strong. But yet, only about 250 were selected to go on the operation.
This is the Dieppe raid.
This is the Dieppe raid. Because this took place in August 42. 19th of August was the actual date it took place. But about 6 weeks to 2 months before the raid, we were sent on troop training to various parts. Most of it was down on the Devon coast and was exercise brandy ball, where we were doing a lot of... well, landings, if you can call them landings. In fact, they weren't landings because the coast along that beach was so rocky that a lot of storm boats and dories and various other landing craft that we were using were just smashed on the rocks. It wasn't very successful, so we thought the whole exercise would be called off because we were sent back to the Seaford area to continue our training. About the early part of August, we'd continued training on a troop basis. I was an F troop at this time, but attached to the old room. Whether you were a cook, bottle washer, batman, driver, whatever, you were a soldier first and a tradesman afterwards. Lord Lovett did the unit training, but each troop did their own troop training. Well, when it came to the actual operation itself, they told us this was going to be a big job, and it was only the officers who were briefed. Remember, I was only a private soldier at this time, so as far as we were concerned, there were no briefing until we boarded the assault ship, the HMS Prince Albert, I think was the name of the ship. When we boarded that ship, Lovett then told us precisely where we were going, what we were going to do, and our training that we had done exactly fitted in with what we were about to do.
What did he tell you?
Well, initially we were going to be split into two groups. Derek Mills Roberts was the senior major who was going to lead one group. This was a number four commando. The other half, the second group, was going to be led by Colonel Lord Lovett himself, and which contained three sections of three troops plus the headquarters. And one was going to land near Berneval. Derek Mills Roberts was going to land near Berneval. And we were going to land about 2 or 3 miles to the west of a place called Verastival. And we were going to be on the mouth of the River Sarn. Now, Derek Mills Roberts' group had the enormous task of going up the cliff. And they had the task of going up where we were expecting to go up as a result of our training down on Exercise Brownie Bowl on the Devon Dorset coast. But we were lucky, Lovett's. We were on the extreme flank where the banks of the River Sarn was flat but slushy on account of the water being like mud flats. And very tall grass. Hard going because we went the long way around. Mills Roberts went direct. We went the long way around because we were going to come in from the back. Our landing was about 4:45 in the morning. And by the time we went across, it was about 7-8 o'clock. There was still quite a lot of firing, but we were lucky in that we had a dry landing. We didn't get the unfortunate opposition as number three commando got further up, because they got very badly mauled. In fact, I think out of about 22 landing craft, I think, I'm not sure, but I believe only about 5 actually touched down. The others were hit. And Peter Young, who was the senior officer, he took the crowd from number three commando. We were very lucky where we were on the extreme opposite flank, further away. We could hear all the battle going on further up. We heard what was happening with the Canadians in Dieppe, and the tremendous noises going on there, but we didn't know what results. Our task was to put out of action the coastal guns, and I believe there were 6 in 2 batteries. There was a 2-gun battery behind Verastival, and there was a 3-gun or a 4-gun battery near Berneval. And they were fairly heavily defended. They had barbed wire surrounding the gun sites. They had flak towers with light anti-aircraft weapons, pom-poms, tremendous number of machine gun posts and snipe posts, minefields all around it. Minefields didn't deter us at all, because the Germans were very clever in their methodic way by signposting them. Achtung Minen. So we, like everybody else, kept well clear of them. Where there were barbed wire entanglements, gaps were blown into the barbed wire by the use of Bangalore torpedoes, but we used to use the aluminium ladders. We'd sling them across the barbed wire entanglements and run across it the same as we were doing in training. No problem at all. The leading troops got pretty badly hit. In F Troop itself, the OC that led us in, he was killed. The subaltern was killed. The sergeant major took over and he was killed. This is where Pat Porteous came in. He was the liaison officer who was liaising between the two groups. He came over, and because there were, well, there were no officers, no NCOs, no warrant officers or anything to lead us, I mean, apart from Lovett, because he was further ahead of us. He led, Pat Porteous led the charge against the gun batteries. Now, he himself was hit in the hand by a German defender, and he killed this German defender and several others. Cunningham was another man who attacked one of these gun batteries, and I can't remember the names of all these other fellows. Anyway, the guns that Mills Roberts were after, he was successful in dealing with them. The ones that Pat Porteous was after, he was successful in dealing with them, but he fell, he got shot again in the thigh, and he got carried back to base. Mills Roberts, meantime, and the rest of the, I think it was A Troop, B Troop, and F Troop, and the headquarters, went in behind Burnville into the wooded area behind and led a rear attack. Now, this all completed by 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and we were given orders to withdraw back to the beach. Instead of going the long way around, the guns had been put out of action, the dead had been collected and placed near the guns, the Union Jack was draped, I can recall, over the British dead. There weren't very many German survivors. Most of them were killed. The very, very few survivors were ushered down the gully where we were. And we went down the route that Mills Roberts had taken to attack the other guns. So we went up one way and down the most direct way.
Did you see any French civilians whilst you were there?
A few. There was a young cyclist, a boy, and an elderly man, a cook, was he? Cook? Butcher? I don't know. He had one of these cook's caps on and a butcher's apron and pinstripes, you know, the smock. I don't know whether he was a cook or a butcher. He spoke to some of the officers that could speak French. I mean, I couldn't speak French at that. Well, I still can't speak French anyway. A few perhaps rude phrases or something, but they were about the only people that I saw, because I think a lot of them, when they heard the banging going around, they were more concerned to keeping their heads down.
What was the demeanour of the ones that you saw?
Very friendly. Astonished. They couldn't understand, obviously, they couldn't understand what was going on, especially when the first noises were taking place. But when they realised it was British forces coming in, they thought that this was an invasion, and hearing all the banging going on and the bombing going on in Dieppe, they really did. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of noise going on because we had Spitfire sorties flying over and machine gunning, well, any defences that they could spot from the air. There were, I think, Boston bombers. They dropped quite a number of bombs. They did a number of sorties. We had a couple of destroyers in our support. Brocklesbank, something like that. And then there was a Polish destroyer, which was also in support of our landing, the Salazar, or some such name. But...
What did you think of the defence that the Germans put up?
Very solid. As I say, where we attacked, we were very lucky in that we had virtually an unopposed landing. It was only after we got onto the beach that the Germans realised that we were where we were, because all the noise was coming over to our left, more to the east. And the other groups, Mills Roberts, he and his group, he was number one group of four commander. We were number two group of four commander. But the ones further in, three commander landed to the other side of Dieppe. We landed on one side of Dieppe. Three commander with Peter Young and Durnford Slater, they landed at a place called Burneville, I think. And they got hammered. They were the people who, unfortunately, out of about 22 landing craft, I think only about five eventually landed. We were lucky in that we didn't lose any landing craft as such, because we had an unopposed landing. And after they went back and stood back in the what they called the boat pool, we transferred from the Prince Albert, by the way, before we got onto the landing craft. We were on the Prince Albert all the way from UK, New Haven, and we transferred over onto landing craft about 10 miles offshore. And once we scrambled down the scramble nets into the landing craft, we went underway, and of course the beach that we could see in the, well, not quite dawn, the false dawn that breaks around about 3:45, 4 o'clock in the morning, was still 8, 9, 10 miles away. But the smoke and the, I suppose, the shell fire that was coming from the port of Dieppe covered the whole thing like a fog. And you could barely see any outlines until we actually hit the shore. We saw the cliffs, but we didn't land at the cliffs. We landed as the cliffs petered out into the mouth of the River Sarn. We evacuated the area around about 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, by which time the landing craft came back to pick us up. We went back to New Haven. We got back to New Haven about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So our day was a long day, an exciting day, for certainly for us. For others, not so very pleasant.
What was your own personal objective?
Our personal objective was to stay in my small section that I was part of was in the wooded area behind the battery of guns with the F troop, well, part of F troop. My personal intervention wasn't to attack the guns or. But if there was any machine gun posts, then we were to deal with them. If there are any snipers, we were to deal with them. And if we heard any firing coming from an alien area, I mean, we knew where our troops were, because we were given fairly good briefings on board the Albert as to exactly where we were going and what we were going to do, the outline of the woods and the models of the area that we were going to be involved in.
Did you hear of any breaches of security with regard to the Dieppe raid?
The breaches of security, yes, the breaches of security we heard. We had an idea that we would be accompanying the Canadians, and unfortunately in the area where we were stationed around Seaford, there was also a lot of Canadian units stationed, and I think the Hamilton Light Infantry, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, and the La Chateau Regiment, they were boasting of the fact, days before the Dieppe Parade, that there was a big operation coming up. And I think I'm right in saying the word Dieppe was mentioned in pubs. As we were not told anything about Dieppe itself, because we weren't told that we were going to land at Dieppe. We were told we were going to go on to Operation Jubilee, which was the name of the operation that was given to the Dieppe raid. And our target would be Varangeville, or Vrastivel in Varangeville. Varangeville was where one battery was, and Vrastivel was the coastal resort where the other battery was.
So you had no inkling that you were going to Dieppe until you were on the ship?
Until we were on the ship, we had no inkling. But we did hear the Canadians talking about what they were going to do. Now, we didn't connect until we were on the ship. We didn't connect that we were going to be part and parcel of it. We heard that the 1st United States Rangers battalion were going to come with us to have a look-see. They later went up before the Dieppe raid, they went up to Hackney Carry to do the commando training. And I think that these people from the 1st United States Ranger battalion, nice enough guys though they are, some of them had seen service in the Pacific. And when they went to Hackney Carry, they were quite astonished to find that we were using live ammunition in training. I think they suffered just as many casualties up there as they did in Dieppe. But, yes, they got their baptism of fire when they went there to Dieppe. But I was working the order room number 4 commander, and I saw maps. I must admit, I knew. When you see the map, you can't deny it. But we were all sworn to secrecy, and we all had these little identification passes with a red cross. It was a green card with a red cross on it, and you had your identification there. Yes, in the order room, I used to type the damned operation orders and the administrative instructions, so I knew what was going on. But my colleagues, the people with whom I used to work with, unless they were exclusively in the know, the only people that were in the know were the people who were immediately associated with us, and of course the officers that used to do the dictation, because I was a shorthand writer. So I used to take the minutes of meetings along with another gentleman called Cliff Luff, and we saw the operation orders, we saw the battle plans, we saw the maps, so we knew precisely where we were going. But the actual telling the people exactly what they were going to do in public, telling everybody, the briefing that we were given, was when we went to the landing ship, Prince Albert.
This was the first time, I think, that you were in combat, for real. Between then and D-Day, were you involved in any other action?
No, no.
Can you tell me the preparations you made for D-Day and the personal part that you played in it?
Yes. Now, after the Dieppe raid, the commandos were sorted out. We were originally SS Brigade. When the Royal Marine Commandos joined the SS Brigade, we got so unwieldy that Combined Operations Headquarters decided to form 4 commando brigades. From being known as the SS Brigade, we became the 1st Special Service Brigade, or 1st Commando Brigade, and then there were 3 others, 2 Commando Brigade, 3 and 4. Now, 1st Commando Brigade consisted of, then, 3 Army Commando, 4 Army Commando, 6 Army Commando, 45 Royal Marine Commando. Now, They were all part of the 1st SS Brigade, later to become the 1st Commando Brigade. We did an awful lot of training from July, August 42, right through till D-Day itself on the 6th of June 1944. Volunteers were being called from these commandos for other operations. There were operations on the island of Sark. There were operations in Madagascar. There were operations in the Middle East. But they were all individual volunteers who'd gone to these various other theatre of operations. But I personally wasn't involved in any of them, because when the then Brigadier of the SS Brigade, Brigadier Laycock, went to North Africa at the end of 1942, his place as the SS Brigade commander was taken by Lord Lovett on promotion from Lieutenant Colonel to Brigadier. He was joined by a lot of officers from No. 4 Commando into Brigade Headquarters, and of course a lot of the order room staff followed him as well. His intelligence officer was Captain Tony Smith, ADC Smith. His DAQMG, Major Max Harper-Gow, who's now titled man, he's Sir Maxwell Harper-Gow. He followed him, and a lot of the staff, the order room staff, came up as well. And we moved from Dorchester to Cowdery House in Midhurst. The whole of 1943 we did training in various functions. We even did jungle training because we thought we were going to be nominated for Burma. But 3 Commando Brigade went to Burma. 2 Commando Brigade went to the Middle East and Italy. And it left numbers 1 and 4 commandos in the United Kingdom for training for the so-called Second Front. Volunteers again were asked, individual volunteers were asked for operations to assist the Boffins, where they used to do nightly raids onto the coast of France, Holland and Belgium, bringing back samples of sand, particles of water, any underwater obstacles that they were able to discover, either at high tide or low tide, study of aerial photographs, units of the Aerial Photographic Interpretation Unit used to study any changes in the outline of the defences in the areas that were, well, being looked at by SHAPE headquarters. And in September 43, we had an exercise called Harlequin, or we participated in an exercise called Harlequin. This was an exercise conducted by Southeast Command Headquarters around the Kent coast, and it was a bluff to see how quickly the Jerry could. Presumably, this is what we were told, it was about to see how quickly the Germans could muster their armoured forces on the continent. And we were located around the Dover area. And we kept going over from these MTBs, because the MTB pens were in Dover, and we kept going over into the channel, and we did this for about 17 nights.